Treatment options for HIV have advanced by leaps and bounds since the AIDS crisis started nearly four decades ago. But these advancements aren't available to all people with HIV. While African-American heterosexual women have the highest HIV rates of any ethnicity, they are significantly less likely to be getting adequate care. Stateside host Cynthia Canty recently spoke with Jaleesia Jolly, a PhD candidate in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan. She studies how HIV-positive Black women are connecting and advocating for some more resources.
So what does the general public not understand about HIV and Black women?
The primary thing I would say, and that my research shows, is the need to address Black women not as medical subjects or sexual objects, but as holistic people, and figure out how to make interventions culturally informed, but also holistic, and addressing not the common things, which is use a condom, take your medication, but really figuring out how can you address some of the inequalities that really make it difficult for people to consistently take the measures to protect themselves and be able to cultivate a life that is meaningful and healthy in its broadest sense.
And is that a particular issue with Black women, or could most any group that has to deal with HIV and AIDS-related illnesses, could they make that argument?
So because HIV/AIDS is an epidemic of intersectional inequalities, what that means is that a lot of these issues are faced by other groups. But there are unique needs that Black women face that are unaddressed.
And what are some of these unique needs? Give us an idea.
Black women living with HIV/AIDS often have to make decisions about focusing on shelter or food or access to financial opportunities or employment opportunities. So what happens oftentimes is HIV can take a backseat to a lot of the sort of basic resources and life things. This includes childcare. This includes figuring out how to navigate romantic relationships, particularly for younger women who are living longer lives with HIV, given their recent medical advances, but are still figuring out how to manage life, family, medication, stigma, and all of the daily things that an HIV-negative person experiences on the regular.
It's a lot of plates to be spinning in the air at one time. That's
indeed
a lot of pressure. You wrote a piece for The Medium, and it was titled What We Can Learn from HIV-Positive Black Women. And in that piece, you point out that globally, AIDS-related illnesses remain the leading cause of death for women of reproductive age. Why hasn't there been more of a focus on HIV/AIDS and women, and particularly Black women?
That is a question that I'm trying to answer with my dissertation, and I think it's a very good question. It's a perennial question that never gets the full response, particularly because I think political will, financial resources, and just general research agendas have just not focused on women and also Black women. Since the start of the epidemic, I think much of the public health responses and interventions have focused on men. I think initially it was viewed as a disease that primarily affects men, to a point where the CDC classifications didn't include the symptoms faced by women.
So there was much spotlight on the plight of men.
Much spotlight
and
on
rightly
the plight
so.
Of men.
I mean, it was when you think of those early years, and particularly in the gay community. My word.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So it does, right.
And
so
kind of we stayed there.
We did stay there. We dwelled there, but we didn't expand it to think about the multiple ways and the multiple populations that it impacts, right?
Yeah.
And what it does then is take a crisis approach to responses to HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. So what that means is if the groups that are considered not so-called, quote-unquote, at risk are deprioritized until there is an outbreak, as opposed to taking preventative methods or directing resources to a sort of more sustainable approach that considers cultural backgrounds or that considers the sort of differences within sexual communities, within groups.
So let's talk about, with prevention methods and strategies and treatment strategies, what can we learn from HIV-positive Black women? What are local groups doing to take this kind of in their own hands?
So a lot of local groups, the ones that I engage are in Detroit, such as Gospel Against AIDS, as well as IFA Life in Kingston, Jamaica. A lot of these local groups are figuring out ways to use local knowledge about sexuality, about sex, about bodies, about healthcare, about myths about HIV and AIDS, to use that to design tailored programs that meet people where they are. And so what this can look like is going into clinics directly. And so going into these communities, engaging people directly. So that can be a condom demonstration workshop. That can be a one-on-one counseling. So that's the one thing that I see. Another thing that I see too is it's been increasingly important too for a lot of local groups to collaborate with other HIV organizing activists that focus on other populations. much of that advocacy work was crucial to getting medication access in the late 80s, early 90s. That I would say that is one of the strengths that I've witnessed in my research, but also in as an HIV tester in Detroit, one of the things I've really noticed is the ways local organizing groups have really connected among each other to address some of these pressing concerns.
You know, it strikes me what you're saying is it's ground up and not top down, which probably gives people greater buy-in. If it's a neighbor looking at me and talking to me about this and trying to enlighten me, that means a whole lot more than somebody parachuting in.
Absolutely. In a conversation I had with one of the HIV positive activists, she looked at me and she said, you know, it helped that someone telling me about this disease was also someone who looked like me, who understood it, who went through it. And although we may not have had the exact same experiences, it meant something to have someone who looked like me tell me about this.
So it, just wondering, because you're involved in AIDS testing, you're doing all of this research, and I'm old enough to remember when we were all covering this advent of this. First, it was the gay disease, and then it grew. So we watched that snowball. We watched it. I remember the day that Magic Johnson announced that he was HIV positive. So it was very, very much top of mind for people. Has it kind of slipped to the background and been kind of crowded out by other issues?
Absolutely. I think a large part behind that slipping to the background has been because there's this narrative around the end of AIDS and around their medication, their advancements, so you can live long lives and you can live forever, and it's no longer the quote-unquote death sentence that it was when the epidemic first became an
issue.
Look
at Magic. That was, you know, early
right.
90s, yeah.
But that yeah. that perspective is yeah. largely false, and it doesn't reflect a lot of the experiences of people in under-resourced communities within the United States, particularly people of color. And importantly, in order to address the multiple dimensions of HIV/AIDS, it requires that we address racism, it requires that we address sexism, it requires that we address deeply rooted inequalities. So I think it requires that we address deep-rooted issues that really intersect to create the perfect storm that makes HIV/AIDS what it is in 2019.
And funding is a big, big part of the fight against HIV/AIDS. And we have seen federal support in the HIV fight dwindle. I mean, the president in his State of the Union speech this year, he talked about we're going to defeat AIDS. And 2 months later, he proposed the largest cuts ever to global HIV programs. And then in late 2017, the Trump administration fired all the members of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. So what is that doing to grassroots efforts like the ones you're studying that to combat mm-hmm. HIV/AIDS?
Mm-hmm. So, right. So a lot of the local groups that I engage have really suffered from this uneven distribution of wealth and public services in both the United States and abroad. And what local groups have been doing is finding various kinds of funders. And of course, it also involves finding ways to build collaborations with other institutions, with other groups, with health departments, also developing. It has involved a lot of alliance building to sort of fight back against a lot of the budget cuts, but it still has a disproportionately mm-hmm. negative impact on the ways group access funding and the longevity of programs.
What has most impressed you, Jalicia Jolly, in doing your work and in, you know, researching and working with HIV-positive Black women?
That question hits home. As I've been doing this work, I've seen women evolve. I've seen their families develop. I've seen women die. And I've seen the continuation of the deprioritizing, the exclusion from important agendas, funding, and resources. But what gives me hope and what keeps me going is when I see the work that's done, that's intergenerational, that's done in creating psychosocial support spaces for women to connect across experiences, is when I see the ways women use their own voice to mobilize each other and to connect to another woman. It's when I see women engage with a variety of stakeholders that can be global organizations, local community groups, public health departments, governments to demand resources to not just save their own lives, but to sort of continue a legacy of support, of advocacy, of community building, of life-saving work that is going to determine if we can end this epidemic at all.
Jalicia Jolly, PhD candidate in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan. Her piece for the Medium is called What We Can Learn from HIV-Positive Black Women. Thanks for being with us, Jalicia. It's been great having you.
Thank you.